Welcome to the Dudes on Movies podcast with your hosts, Scott Charbonneau and David Lynn Miller.
Welcome to Dudes on Movies. I'm your dude, Scott.
I'm your dude, Dave.
And today is our listener response show for the April questions of the week. We're going to read through some of your responses and let you know what we think. Mm-hmm. Up first is Pump Up the Volume. We asked, what are your favorite teen angst movies? And on Facebook, Tom said, as always, I'm going left field with my choices. First is Chronicle from 2012, a rare blend of angst and teenagers with superpowers. My second just about hits that criteria, and I guarantee nobody else has thought of it. It's also one of the greatest films of all time, Beetlejuice.
Whew, man. Yeah, that is an angsty picture.
I know, and I never think of it as angsty.
Right.
But Winona Ryder is pure angst. I mean,
yes.
That's all she is in that movie.
Her whole look, like, launched 1,000 outfits. Everybody wanted to look like that.
Lydia Deetz wasn't even a Halloween costume. It was a lifestyle.
Yes, very much so. Like, people have made that their whole personality and identity.
And I like it.
Yeah, same, right.
I made it part of my life. It was fine, everybody.
Right. Winona Ryder became both of our everything.
And also, on Chronicle there, I've never seen it, but I've been wanting to watch it. Have you ever watched Chronicle?
Yeah.
I've heard it's pretty good, mm-hmm. and it's a unique take on superhero stuff.
Right.
So thanks, Tom. Those are awesome responses. And on Facebook, also, WN Movie Talk Podcast says, we just recently watched Ghost World, starring Thora Birch and Scarlett Johansson, based on the graphic novel. My wife commented that it reminded her so much of her transition between teenager and adult and finding your place in the world that out of all the films she's seen about teens, especially teenage girls, it was the most accurate portrayal for her.
Pretty cool.
Ghost World is excellent. Yes. I just recently picked it up and, I mean, I'd seen it before, but God, I just love it. It's so good. Thora Birch is so underrated, especially in that film.
Oh, I know. And like, to have early Scarlett Johansson like that too, you know,
yeah.
Really cool. And everybody should also check out the graphic novel. It's definitely worth a read.
Yeah. And awesome Steve Buscemi in that
yep.
movie too.
Mm-hmm.
So awesome. Thanks, man. Carly sent us a message on Facebook. She said, favorite and most rewatched teen angst movie, The Breakfast Club. Well-written, funny, and relatable. Teen angst movies I liked but will never ever watch again, Bully, Kids, and Virgin Suicides. They were all so important and innovative, but so effing hard to watch a second time. Virgin Suicides has the best 70s soundtrack, Hearts. The old 80s version of Suburbia was impactful at the time, but it's not really a great movie. Banging soundtrack, though. Never saw the remake.
Mm.
Thanks, Carly. These are all excellent.
Absolutely.
Breakfast Club, obviously, right?
Yes.
Might be an all-time angst movie.
Right.
Yeah.
It's going to come up in like a few of our questions, actually.
Yeah, I think it's going to run through this one.
Yes.
we need to get it on the schedule and do it eventually.
We do. Absolutely.
Also, Bully, Kids, and Virgin Suicides. Yeah, a bunch of heavy hitters there. Virgin Suicides, I don't think hit as hard as Bully or Kids,
right?
But it's still a very tough subject matter.
Yes, and it launched Sofia Coppola, obviously, into, like, you know, she's now a great director.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And about Bully in particular, of all of Larry Clark's films that are, you know, a difficult watch, I think that one is his best movie. And I know what a pervert he is. I do, you know, but like, I think that's part of what makes that movie so good.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, like when a camera lingers like that on a sex scene and it feels very much like sweaty fumbling the way it does.
Yeah.
You know, wow, that's effective.
I go to the thrift stores a lot, everybody, and buy some DVDs if I find them. And I saw Bully there the other week. And I grabbed it. I was like, oh, Bully, like for 99 cents or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I grabbed it. It was a different Bully. It was like some weird knockoff fucking cheap crap made in 2004. Oh. I was like, no.
Oh, man.
This isn't it.
Okay.
Putting it back.
Yeah, that sucks.
But yeah, awesome. And Suburbia, I never watched it, actually.
Right.
All right, Dave, what do you have for your answers?
Well, obviously, yeah, we've all seen a lot of movies that speak to our, you know, disaffection as teenagers. And whether you're recording this podcast or listening to it, you know, some of these feelings have harbored long into adulthood. you know, sometimes I'd fantasize that I was one of those characters that I admired, you know, or at least that I was as cool or as charismatic as those characters. And the ones that most spoke to me back then and still do were the Breakfast Club's already been mentioned, Dazed and Confused. And
yeah,
this is going to sound weird, but Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah.
It's not about teen angst exactly. Obviously, it's definitely not. But
it's a vampire. It's very angsty.
It is. Yeah. And like, it got me very interested in like goth culture. And I was so proud of myself for having read that book. I literally finished the book and then like 2 hours later, I went to the movies, you know?
Oh, wow.
It was because I had to get it in. I saw the movie with like, you know, 4 or 5 friends and I wanted to, you know, like get it in. Like, and I'm there. Okay. I got it. Okay. Now I'm ready to see the film.
Oh.
And like, you know, we were there opening night and when I saw it, I wanted people to look at me and think I was as beautiful and strong as Lestat, you know, which isn't the most honorable thing to admit, but I was really full of myself back then, you know?
Well, I think a lot of people would have liked that, right?
Of course. Yeah. You know, it's absolutely like, that is what you want the world to see you as, someone who is like, who has such power and sex appeal.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And that you can do anything. I mean, it's just, it's a really strong magnetic way of living. And, you know, it's just out of our grasp, unfortunately. But when you're a teenager, you think it's possible.
Yeah.
And there was also Rebel Without a Cause, which was kind of a special case. I saw that movie in freshman year theater class. And I might have told the story in the podcast before, but, you know, while we were watching the first 30 minutes and we're following James Dean to the observatory, me and everyone else in the class like shot each other these like knowing looks, because we all started to recognize that even though it was our first time seeing this movie, we were familiar with most of what we were seeing because we'd all seen Paula Abdul's video for her song Rush Rush. you know, in that video, the settings and costumes are a tribute to Rebel. But because we were unschooled in the 1990s, none of us knew this. We didn't know we were watching an homage.
Yeah.
We just thought Paula Abdul decided to make a video that looked like it was in the 50s and Keanu Reeves was her love interest with a red jacket. And all of a sudden we're just watching this movie going, oh my God, where have we seen this before? Oh, it's the Paula Abdul video. So there we are.
That happened so much, man. I remember watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and they're doing James Cagney.
Yes.
And I'm like, I don't know what that is. And then I watch Public Enemy and I'm like, oh, well, okay, that's Ninja Turtles. what is that?
It was the same thing we were talking about one time, like when you watched Wayne's World 2 and you, yeah, and like, they used the end
Graduate?
Of The Graduate. Yes. Yeah. There was a moment too for The Graduate where like, I remember watching the video for George Michael's Too Funky. And there's a sample in that song that's just Anne Bancroft saying, would you like me to seduce you? And I didn't know what that was until I saw the movie years later, you know?
Oh my God. Dude, my face hurts, dude. You're making me laugh too much.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Oh, you have any more picks there?
Oh, no, that was
okay,
because
you took a lot of mine.
Okay.
But yeah, I got... Some you didn't mention, I put Superbad as one of my favorite teen angst movies.
Yes.
You know, these two kids who are best friends and they're growing up and going to go their separate ways and they're so afraid of what the future is going to bring. It's just such a realistic portrayal of these dumbass teenage boys. Yes. And what they think of the world.
Right.
But it's also very sweet. And my favorite that's not Dave's favorite is Dead Poets Society.
Oh, man.
Peter Weir's awesome film.
Yes.
With some amazing performances all around.
Right.
And tragic tale, Robert Sean Leonard. And
Dude. It is very, very well acted.
Yeah.
It's good. And it's a classy film. And Robert Sean Leonard, he does a great job.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just didn't like the movie. That's all right.
Exactly. That's fine. It's okay to not like movies, everybody.
Yes.
But yeah, I love that film and... probably my favorite teen angst film.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to Alien 3, Dave. Mm-hmm. What polarizing franchise films do you most admire? Carly sent us a message on Facebook. She said the Halloween films. She goes on a whole thing here, Dave, about each film.
Yeah, let's hear
it. So she says she loves Halloween 1 and 2. And then she says 3 through The Curse of Michael Myers. Thumbs down.
Yeah.
I think that's 3 through 6.
Yeah.
The one with Paul Rudd is the 6th one, everybody. Halloween H2O, totally fun. Resurrection, thumbs down.
Okay.
So Halloween H2O was like the first reboot with like Josh Hartnett. I had that on VHS and I watched it a ton. And Michelle Williams is in it?
Yeah.
Right? Oh God, I loved it.
The stars come out.
LL, he's in it?
Yeah.
She continues here. Rob Zombie versions, Triple Hearts. She loves those ones.
Ah.
I've never watched those ones, though.
Oh, yeah. Those are good.
Okay. Then here, the David Gordon Green trilogy, Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills. I was totally into The Darkness of Them, thumbs up. And Halloween Ends, boo. This franchise is all over the place and rewrites timelines and storylines all the time, and some people get bogged down by, and others don't care. I like what I like about the different ones I enjoyed and choose to ignore the ones that were uber stupid. The end of Halloween Kills, where Michael Myers takes out a lawn full of vigilantes, is 100% rewatchable to me. That movie, for that scene alone, is pretty great. Have a great day, dudes.
Awesome.
Thanks, Carly. We love when you write in,
yeah,
especially when you get some awesome stuff like this. And I agree with her. The first two David Gordon Green movies are pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the second one, especially the end when he murders everyone. I love that.
I don't know why people are so tough on the second movie.
I don't know.
You know, I did not see Judy Greer's end coming.
Me neither.
Know? And when Michael fights off all those right-wing assholes, it's great. You know?
Anthony Michael Hall gets it.
Yes.
Come on, everybody.
He deserves, you know, like, Evil Dies Tonight. Well,
the movies were very grounded in reality, right?
Yeah.
But then at this moment, it turns supernatural.
Yeah.
And I was there for it. I was like, dude, this is amazing.
Right.
He's just the killing machine. He's back.
And they really put the boots to him. I mean, like, they are beating him, like, senseless. And
yeah, he should be dead.
He should be dead, and he's not, and they all should be, and they're not. Some of them do, but yeah not enough of them.
Yeah.
He couldn't kill enough vigilantes, for my taste.
Right.
You know?
And on the third one, I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
I didn't love it, but I don't think it's bad per se. It just takes a totally different route.
Right. If they got rid of Corey entirely, it wouldn't have, like, you know, it would have been a different movie, but I think that's probably what people complain about the most.
Yeah.
You know, which I thought was okay. I didn't love it, but when I have to admit, I was legitimately like, oh my God, when that kid dies in the first sequence, like when he breaks his neck.
Yeah, dude.
Falling off those stairs. I was like, oh my Lord. They really killed this kid.
There's some grisly shit in that movie.
Yes. When Lori and her granddaughter just full on meticulously murder Michael on the countertop, it is brutal.
It's very brutal. I feel like it's appropriate, though. Like, they're actually going to finish it instead of being dumb horror movie victims.
I know, right.
You know?
Right.
I really appreciated that.
Sure, yeah. They're like, covering all their bases, and then they even go further with it, of course, the famous ending.
Yes.
Where we actually watch him, you know, like get eaten up by a trash compactor. I mean, like, we have to do this. Otherwise,
exactly.
It didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Unless he, like, morphs back into shape somehow, he's gone.
If he's got T-1000 powers, that's, you know, yeah.
Oh, man, yeah. The movie reminded me a lot of Nightmare on Elm Street 2, how, like, Freddy's kind of inside of Mark Patton's character, Jesse. He's like, the surrogate for Freddy, and that's kind of how the third film here is.
Yeah.
Like, he's, like, the surrogate for the evil.
Yeah.
It's still okay.
Yeah, I think it's good.
All right, my pick for this one, Dave. What franchise film do I most admire? What polarizing one? I'm a huge fan of The Last Jedi.
Oh.
I love Star Wars 8.
Okay.
I know it has some huge major flaws in it.
Yeah.
But I just love how Rian Johnson just took it in a totally different way that you didn't expect it to go. And he just didn't care about, like, finishing storylines. Like,
yeah.
He just, like, took it in a bold direction that I was happy to see. It was refreshing. Even though, like, it wasn't perfectly executed or makes a lot of sense in some ways, I just really loved how willing he was to just take it somewhere new. And I think it might be one of the most visually striking Star Wars films.
Okay.
Like, it just looks excellent.
So that is my favorite of the sequel trilogy.
I'm glad to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think that's a great movie.
It has a lot of flaws, too.
Sure.
Like every single Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's people who will kill you if you say you like it.
I know.
And people who want to marry you if you say you like it.
It is
totally the most polarizing of all the Star Wars films.
Polarizing is the word.
Yep. All right, Dave, what do you got?
Well, I think we're both in agreement that Godfather 3 is a much better film than most critics gave it credit for.
Yes.
You know? And I wish the people who were still tough on it would sit down to watch it again like we did a few years back.
Yep.
And just like go, oh my gosh, this movie's great. You know?
Yeah.
There's just a ton to like about it. I know it's not part one or part two. That much is true.
Yeah.
But like, it's still, as a standalone film, it is well acted. And if you like The Godfather, you're going to like Godfather 3. There's no reason for you not to like it.
Right.
You
know? And I think now that we're years past it, right, 30 years down the line plus, you can reevaluate it without the context of the, without the zeitgeist polluting you.
Yes, of course. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also like Beneath the Planet of the Apes from 1970. It's the second film in the original series, and because the first one is such a masterpiece, the response to this one was kind of lukewarm at the time, less favorable. But like, in this film, we find that there are intelligent humans that the apes didn't know about. They've been deformed by nuclear radiation, and they have these telekinetic powers that they use to defend themselves. It's a subversive movie, and I think it's really underrated. Because it deals with nuclear proliferation, of course, and all the like the complications from that. The humans worship a bomb. It's their god.
Okay.
And at one point, like when they all reveal, like because they have like regular, like they look like regular humans, but they're it's actually just a costume. That their real selves are this, you know, like their epidermis is missing, you know, and
because
they've been, you know,
so they're like radiation victims.
Yes.
That sounds awesome.
It's
I haven't seen that movie.
Yeah, it's so good.
I've only watched the original one.
Okay.
I've never seen any of the sequels from the original series.
Oh, dude. Oh, yeah. Those are essential.
I got to check
all
them out.
Five of them. Yeah. That whole first series is so good.
Okay.
And I'd also encourage everybody to seek out Psycho 2. If you like Anthony Perkins in the first movie, which we all do, you'll feel the same way about him in this sequel that came out over 20 years later. He plays Norman just as boyishly as before, but he's now like 50-ish.
Yeah.
And it comes off charming, if unnatural, which is a lot to process, you know, because like he's very wet behind the ears, but he's like a middle-aged man.
Yeah.
And I also like Scream 2, even though I totally understand why a lot of people don't like it.
Okay.
Know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It could have been way better. Because they probably should have waited a little while before they made it. But it was like, I think they started production on it like maybe 8 months after the first one came out.
Yeah.
I think it came out the year after the first one was released.
Yeah.
It might have been like less than a year. It was some really ridiculous turnaround. But it felt very rushed. And my last pick is I like the movie Hannibal.
That's right.
I have seen
that
movie so many times, and I'll save my comments for the day we inevitably do an episode on it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I think I told the story about how I snuck into that film.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
I don't know what episode, but it was probably one of these question of the weeks.
I think it was. Yeah.
I got kicked out, and then I snuck back in. Anyway, thanks for the responses on that question. We're going to move along to Bill and Ted Face the Music. The question is, what is your favorite Legacy sequel? On Facebook, Tom chimed in, "Hey dudes, this is a challenge as it really depends on the meaning of legacy. What kind of time period is needed before it becomes such? Nevertheless, I have an answer, and one which is from way out in territory that few will think of. The Color of Money. Excuse my non-US English spelling." You're excused, Tom. We understand. "A great film from one of the greatest directors. I'll throw in Blade Runner 2049 as an also-ran."
Yes.
Color of Money, man. I wouldn't have thought of that.
I wouldn't have either, and it's the ultimate. It might be like the very first.
I was going to say that.
You know?
It could have been,
yeah,
man. Like, Paul Newman is so good in that.
Yeah.
Did he get nominated for that movie?
That was his Best Actor Oscar.
That was his win.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. But yeah, Color of Money is a great movie, and it really explores where his character went from the first movie,
yes,
right? So, awesome.
Yeah, I watched The Hustler maybe about a year ago. That movie is awesome. And Jackie Gleason is great in it. George C. Scott is great in it. And of course, Paul Newman. I mean, what can you say?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Blade Runner 2049, I haven't seen it. I need to.
Yeah.
Have you?
Yes.
Are we not talking about Blade Runner?
No, listen, obviously, you and I famously don't care for Blade Runner.
Yes.
But I had to see I eventually did see the movie. The
I do want to see it just so I can say I saw it.
Yeah. I just felt like it was something I had to be there for. And it is good. I like it way better than the original.
Yeah.
You know, and the visuals on it are amazing. And like that giant Ana de Armas.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
It's very cool, you know? Yeah. And yeah, it is a good movie.
Okay, cool. I remember we scratched it from one of our Oscar episodes like years ago.
Uh-huh.
Cause we were like, well, if we watch this movie, then we can add another category to our episode. We're like, nah.
Yeah.
Right. Nah. We got enough. It's good.
Yeah. Our plate was full.
All right, man. Thanks, Tom. That was awesome.
Uh-huh.
And Carly chimes in with another message. The questions are getting harder. LOL. I'm having to take some time to narrow down answers and I love it. Favorite legacy sequel is hands down Terminator 2. Robert Patrick's liquid AI was the most amazing thing I'd seen on film at the time, and making the original villain from Terminator 1 the hero in the sequel was mind-blowing at first watch. The best sequel ever, and I'll never change my mind. Hear, Carly. That's very good.
Absolutely.
I agree with pretty much all that stuff. When did Terminator 2 came out? Like, it was like 7 or 8 years after the original, right?
It was 7 years after, and okay. It feels like it was about 27 years
doesn't
after.
Doesn't it? Because you know? The technological jump was insane.
Like, think how dingy Terminator was.
That movie is so grimy.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
It feels dirty and nasty, because that's what it was. It was like a B-grade movie being made, right?
Right.
But it just was a phenomenon when it came out.
Yes.
T2, definitely up there for sequels. My answers here, I picked, one of them is Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, man.
Which is just an amazing legacy sequel. Not even really about Mad Max, per se. It's about Furiosa.
Yes. Fury Road is like one of the best movies ever made.
It's so awesome.
Yeah.
I remember my brother went and saw it in the theater. I didn't catch it in theaters, but he came home and told me, he was like, this is like the best movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And now they got Furiosa that came out and apparently is not too bad either.
I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah. But, some of my other picks here, Creed
from
the Rocky franchise.
Yeah.
It's more of a reboot than a legacy sequel, but I mean, Stallone is present in it.
Yeah.
So my real legacy sequel pick is Rocky Balboa, which is Rocky VI that came out before Creed.
Right.
Which also came out like 15 years after Rocky V. You get to see Rocky as an old man now, and he's dealing with the fallout of boxing over all the years, which he has been throughout the rest of the series.
But yes, like, he has, right.
He owns an Italian restaurant now,
yeah.
And it's about not giving up, just like Rocky and stuff. But it's about him dealing with his adult son, played by Milo Ventimiglia, who's really good in the role.
Right.
And just dealing with life stuff and Rocky stuff. So, but it's just such an awesome, sweet take on the character. And I thought it'd be the last time we see Rocky.
Right. Instead, he shows up in Creed, and Sylvester Stallone wins the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah.
For his performance as Rocky Balboa in Creed.
Amazing.
It was good. Yeah.
Yeah. Creed's excellent.
Right.
What do you got, Dave?
Well, so I like most of Clerks 2. You know.
I never saw it.
Okay. My one major beef with this movie is the Tijuana Donkey Show. I know you didn't see the movie, but there's this,
I can have an idea of what's happening.
I mean, it's just shameful, you know, and it's so juvenile and just like smutty and terrible. And it's really hard to defend Kevin Smith sometimes because of these kinds of choices.
I know. And he's like, well, that's my style.
Right.
Well, okay. Maybe you shouldn't do that.
Dude, listen.
Even if it's your style.
I know. Exactly. I know I say a lot of dirty words on this podcast, but I don't talk about pee-pees and poops and doo-doo pies and all that shit. I try to at least sound like an adult, you know, and
right.
When we do something like, I'm sorry, it was just too much. But like, this is going to sound strange because it's not part of the movie, but like I remember when I watched the behind the scenes stuff on the DVD, there's footage of Kevin Smith smoking a cigarette in the editing room, and he's showing the movie to Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez. And at one point he asked them if he thought the ending was too predictable. And Quentin's like, oh, no way. You know, it never occurred to me that they were going to like buy the store. I liked that a lot. And I thought that was just a cool thing. I wanted to watch more of that. than sit through Clerks 2 again.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, listening to those guys talk about a movie.
Yeah, it was cool.
Do that forever.
Yes. And obviously, Carly mentioned it earlier, Count Me also is one of David Gordon Green's fans of the Halloween series. You know, I especially like the first one because it's so brutal, and they clean up all that nonsense from the original sequels, and Jamie Lee Curtis is excellent in it. And one thing, too, about what Carly's message about the not liking Halloween 3, I remember I responded back to her like, oh, tell me more, you know?
Yeah.
And I was very surprised by that.
I'm sure you're heartbroken. I know you really like that one.
I really like that movie, and it just, it was so different and like such a huge departure from the rest of the series. Yeah. I mean, it exists almost on its own. It doesn't even need to be called Halloween 3. It should just be called, you know,
Season of the Witch.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, everything's great.
Yeah. Cool. All right, let's move on to Tiptoes, Dave.
God damn.
Ready? It's back.
I can't believe I have to keep saying that word.
We're almost done.
Right.
All right. What are the most embarrassing parts of the careers of your favorite actors or filmmakers? On Facebook, Alan says, Bob Costas would prefer you never mention basketball.
Yes. He de-basketballs himself in that film.
Yes, really bad.
Wow. So does Al Michaels, actually.
Both of them do.
Yes.
Yeah, don't they like just like drop jaws at like slutty cheerleaders, yes, or something like that, and they, like make poop jokes?
They
and,
do. Yeah. I couldn't believe the two of them like did that stuff.
I'm a fan of basketball. I think it's very offensive and juvenile, but I watched it many times as a young man, uh-huh, and I should revisit it.
So the opening sequence where they're like talking about like the de-evolution of like team sports.
Yeah.
And they show like the elaborate touchdown celebration.
Yes.
That's very funny.
That is really good.
Yeah.
And they start doing like some kind of Celtic line dance.
Yes. Yeah. A full like soft shoe Michael Flatley thing.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah. It's a very inventive idea. And we used to play basketball like out on the basketball court, my friends and I. Like, yeah. It was a fun game, actually.
Yeah, of course, right. It when you actually got to do it, it actually, it was enjoyable.
Yep. All right, Carly messaged us again. Carly's Corner, we should call this. We love you, Carly.
Uh-huh.
She says, I heart Ben Affleck. As a writer and director and sometimes actor, I think he's super smart and takes risks I appreciate. Gone Baby Gone is so well directed. The Town and Argo as an actor and director are both a chef's kiss from me. Loved him in Live by Night and Gone Girl as an actor, and Good Will Hunting is a masterpiece. Come on. He's just had trouble in the middle trying to be an actor or an action hero and romantic lead. Boo! Daredevil blows. Armageddon blows. Forces of Nature, Geely, Jersey Girl, gross. Just stop. But I loved him in Surviving Christmas. I don't know why. It's a charming film all around. I don't even care that he's good looking. He's just a super talent, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, well said. I mean,
yeah, that was a very surprising moment for Surviving Christmas.
I've never seen it.
I've seen clips of it.
Okay.
And I remember like the trailer. I remember actually a still from that movie that was in the review in Entertainment Weekly. Ben Affleck is making a real stupid face, and like James Gandolfini is behind him with a shovel about to brain him.
Just like, well, that sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, you'd think it would be pretty cool, but like I you know, the rest of the clips I saw didn't measure up to that one still.
So that didn't get the message across.
No,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sucks.
Right.
All right. Is it my turn to go or is it your turn?
I believe it's yours. Yeah.
Okay. So I've got a few answers here. A couple I thought of, Al Pacino in Jack and Jill doing the Dunkachino commercials.
Oh man. Yeah. Dunkachino. Jesus. Yeah.
Which I honestly haven't seen the movie, but I know all about the clip with Al Pacino.
Yeah.
And it's something. Apparently he was all in on it though. Like he knew what he was getting into. And apparently while filming, he said, this is going to end me, because he knew how horrible it was.
Right.
You could probably mention half of Nicolas Cage's career. Johnny Depp doing the Lone Ranger, the
Oof.
Tonto stuff. That's
Woof.
Pretty bad.
Oh, man.
On so many levels.
Yes.
I don't care what you think about all the weird characters he does. This is just inappropriate.
I know. I know.
And then Michael J. Fox in Teen Wolf. When they're talking about not being gay and stuff.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that
Styles,
stuff is
yeah.
That's a pretty low point for an actor
yeah.
when you're you'd rather be a werewolf than homosexual. It's pretty appalling in today's view.
Here. Yeah. That's bad. You're right. Yeah.
But my number one thing here is Eddie Murphy's Raw and Delirious specials. They are so offensive and inappropriate. I can't even stand them.
There's just like one routine that you can get through.
No. And I know he has like disowned them recently, which is good.
Sure.
Because he's grown and learned, which everyone should be doing. But good Lord, those things have not aged well.
I know.
And I can't believe that was acceptable.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Man.
It was not only acceptable, it was A-list.
It was. That was the funniest thing ever made.
Of course.
Right?
Right.
And it wasn't even a joke. It was just him saying the F word.
Yeah.
That's it.
The F slur.
F slur.
Yeah.
That's the joke. He said that word.
And I mean, like, I remember Raw, it had a theatrical release. I think Delirious did too, but I specifically remember Raw because it was like the long-awaited sequel, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, this was box office. You're going to see a comedian do a lot of, you know, randy jokes about being gay.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, Larry the Cable Guy doesn't say the F slur, but he says a lot of other shit. Yeah. You know, so it's continued to this day.
Yeah, it still goes on.
Right.
But yeah, these are some low points in these guys' careers.
Yes,
so
agreed.
That's what I got. What do you have?
Well, I found this category difficult, surprisingly difficult, because I thought we were just going to really go off.
But yeah.
It's hard to find something as embarrassing as Gary Oldman and Tiptoes.
I sat there for like 30 minutes like, all right, and I was able to like ooze stuff out of my brain.
Yes, finally it came out, right. Man, I guess like what you said about Michael J. Fox was good because, number one, it was unexpected, but also because like I'm trying to think of like just truly something where you just go, oh my God, I can't even look at this. But in the case of him, it's one scene in a movie where he did something that he would think better of today.
Right.
But he didn't think better of it back then. So that is embarrassing. And every time you do something like that, I remember there's a really terrible movie called Hamburger the Motion Picture. Okay, now this is, everybody, I know none of you have seen this. Only I have seen it. Because that's who I am. But like, Dick Butkus is in that movie.
Really?
And at the end, he says, I can't repeat what he says, but he's talking to a African-American gentleman. And he uses the phrase Kunta Kinte to describe this man.
Okay.
Okay. And he says some other racial shit, too. I know Dick Butkus didn't write the screenplay.
Yeah.
But he still said the words. So just like Michael J. Fox, he could have, like, everybody in those moments could like, take the director. It's like, can we say something else?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely their fault. I have not been able to look at Dick Butkus, you know, for however long, just because I know he said those stuff, and he was okay with it, you know?
Yeah, I can't believe that.
Right.
And well, now you got me thinking about like John Wayne or something. Like,
man, oh my gosh.
Don't listen to that guy.
Yes, John Wayne, what a piece of shit. It was great watching the Bryan Cranston's Trumbo.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because they make John Wayne the absolute villain of the movie.
It's so good,
man. That's great.
Yes, I love that.
But what stands out also, obviously, right away is John Travolta in Battlefield Earth. He's embarrassing for different reasons.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yes. He's still paying for it. And, you know, and
he's been paying for it ever since.
He has. And I think it's because he doesn't have a sense of humor about it. He's never like come out and just going, you know, okay, you know, guys, all right, that one got by me. I tried this and here's what I was going for, but, you know, it didn't work out. He's like stuck by it. And he's just like, no, here's why this is good.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, I'm sorry. You're not
your losses.
Yes. Enough. And I guess you could throw Forrest Whitaker in there because he was kind of collateral damage in that movie.
Oh, yeah. You
know,
that's right.
That's a real low point for him. You know, I think... man, Roland Jaffe directed The Killing Fields.
Yeah.
You know, obviously one of my all-time favorite films.
It's an excellent film.
Yes. Yeah. One of the most important movies ever made.
Listen to our episode, everybody.
Yes.
I think it's one of our finest, actually.
Yes, absolutely. He also made 1995's The Scarlet Letter, a movie that misses the point. of its source material entirely. It adds a Native American attack on the Puritans at the end of the film, and it lets the religious hypocrites off the hook in the end.
Okay.
Gary Oldman was very handsome, and Demi Moore was very beautiful, and we need those two movie stars to get together in the end. So they took Nathaniel Hawthorne's tale of Puritan oppression, and they turned it into that. And Roland Joffe was behind it. It's just, wow, what a shame.
Oh, my God.
And I guess while we're here, I might not get the opportunity to go off on the careers of Jason Friedberg and Aaron Seltzer again, but they're the men behind Epic Movie.
Oh,
and Disaster Movie, and The Starving Games, and a handful of other films that attempt to parody mainstream film and television.
No.
these films have no wit, no character, really nothing to say. And all they do is restage stuff that happened in a movie you saw 6 months ago. And that's supposed to be, and that's the joke. That's supposed to be funny, you know? So they're not exactly the most embarrassing parts of their careers because that's been their whole careers, but I know we'll never do one of their movies. So here's what I think about them, everybody. Here comes my opinion on, you know, Jason Friedberg and Aaron Seltzer.
Yeah.
There we are.
I don't think I'll ever throw one of those on.
No,
on
probably
there.
Not. Probably not. Yeah, not even an experiment. Cause we would just, we'd be, oh my God. My head would explode. I would be like hoarse from yelling and screaming, and yeah, terrible.
The podcast would be over. It'd
yes.
Just implode.
Right.
Okay. Should we move on?
Sure.
To Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. What are your favorite pop songs that were made famous by a movie? All right. We got a good list here, Dave. Let's go down here. Tom says, I have two answers out of many, but these two are in my top five favorite songs of all time. A View to a Kill by Duran Duran.
A View to Kill, yeah.
Yeah. Together in Electric Dreams by Phil Oakley.
that's a deep one. Nice.
Yeah, like, by the way, I listened to all these songs. Like, once I put this together, I was like, I got to listen to them all. And yeah. I'd heard most of them before. But,
yeah.
So it was really nice kind of going through this time warp of pop music.
Uh-huh.
I loved it. But yeah, those are good songs.
Yeah.
I could list about 40 off the top of my head for this. Just look at the Rocky 3 and 4 soundtracks, Top Gun, Dirty Dancing for most of them. Yeah. On Instagram, we had a comment from Brian Adams Indonesian Fans Club.
Yes,
and they said, Everything I Do by Brian Adams. Of course.
I know.
Right?
I'm still investigating the Indonesian Fan Club, but, you know.
It just seems so out of left field.
Yeah.
But, hey, you know, makes sense. Everything I Do.
Yeah.
Brian Adams. Alan chimed in on Instagram, old time rock and roll, Bob Seger, help that Tom Cruise kid along.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah. WN Movie Talk podcast said, I remember when Godzilla came out, the Roland Emmerich version from the 90s, absolutely loving the soundtrack, the film, not so much. Like many Emmerich films, Independence Day included, the movie starts off really well, outsizing the likes of Jaws, Jurassic Park, etc. But boy, do his films go to shit midway onwards. Anyway, Deeper Underground by Jamiroquai and Puff Daddy's Come With Me were played a lot by my friends and me that summer. I might as well be your friend because I lived the same life. The Godzilla soundtrack. Oh, my God, dude. And you know what's sad is that's how I learned that Kashmir was a Led Zeppelin song.
You know what? This is how we learn things.
I know. We just talked about that.
Right. That's okay.
But yeah, Come With Me by Puff Daddy was like my anthem. And I had that VHS of Godzilla and watched it about 400 too many times.
That is quite, I mean, like, I remember at one point in the movie, they made fun of Roger Ebert. Like, they make the mayor into like a big blubbering fat guy, and his name's Ebert, you know, because they were pissed off at him for like giving Independence Day a bad review.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
That is some harsh revenge.
Uh-huh.
I think I just liked it because Ferris Bueller was in it.
Yes.
It's like, oh, Ferris Bueller and Godzilla.
Right.
Also on Instagram, Jeff Zuckerman says, I mean, it wasn't because there's no justice, but in another universe, because this is supposed to be a pop hit, right? But in another universe, it was Run With Us by Lisa Loheed over the end credits of Hobo with a Shotgun.
Oh, God. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And I listened to that song and I was like, this is the jam right here.
Yes.
This is like pure 80s synth grime and like getting it done.
Absolutely,
music. Oh,
yeah.
I loved it. And apparently it's the tie-in song for a Canadian TV show called The Raccoons.
I did not know that.
It's
wow.
An animated show. Yeah.
Okay.
Carly comes in on the messenger again. I love Irene Cara's voice, and I used to sing the soundtrack from Fame in my basement at the top of my lungs. And Annie, too, but I'd deny that. So here's our list. Fame, Irene Cara. Out Here on My Own, Irene Cara, both from Fame. In Your Eyes, Peter Gabriel, Say Anything. Stay, Lisa Loeb, Reality Bites. Lose Yourself, Eminem, 8 Mile. Gangsta's Paradise, Coolio, Dangerous Minds. Shallow, Lady Gaga, A Star Is Born. I think those songs sum up the vibe of the films they represent. But shout out to the whole soundtracks that do the same thing. Purple Rain, Pretty in Pink, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Virgin Suicides, Trainspotting. Hard to pick one song as the record does so much for the whole film in each case, and they're not pop songs so much except Purple Rain. You dudes rule. Thank you. I've learned so much in the last three pods as I've not seen any of those films. Love to listen though. All right, Carly. Thanks,
thank you,
man.
So much,
you
Carly.
You rule too.
Yes.
But yeah, these singles she mentioned here, like, I'm a huge sucker for Stay by Lisa Loeb.
Oh my God.
I freaking adore this song. It's like a guilty pleasure of mine.
I find it just an absolute pleasure. You know,
it's amazing.
I don't find it guilty at all. I just sit there and, like, you know, be a sensitive ponytail man listening to that song.
I know,
you
know? Man. And I wanted her to be my girlfriend so bad.
She was just, I mean, like, she had the great, those cool glasses on.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I remember when Rachel Lee Cook got on the scene, she looked like Lisa Loeb. I was like, okay, I'm in love with Rachel Lee Cook now.
Dude, I remember seeing a picture of, like, Lisa Loeb. She's sitting next to Ethan Hawke, who's petting a cat.
Ooh.
And I was like, this is 1994 all over the place. And like, he looks real sensitive in the shot, and she's got her arm around him. I'm like, yeah, that's where I want to be.
Dude,
you know?
Ben Stiller's there and Winona Ryder.
And Janine Garofalo.
Oh, that's good time, man.
Right.
But yeah, Lose Yourself from 8 Mile, I loved that song.
Yeah, of course.
Gangster's Paradise was amazing. I remember when that was a hit.
Yeah.
I was just like, this is the best song ever. Weird Al had to parody it.
Yes.
That's how good it was.
And he ended up having to write a letter of apology to Coolio, because Coolio wasn't having it.
He didn't give him consent.
Yeah. Eventually, they did make up.
Which, I think legally, he doesn't have to
get
consent, but he always did.
Yeah.
Oh, man, those are some excellent picks.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, Dave, my turn or your turn? I'm losing track.
Yeah, me too. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay, I'll go here. I've got like probably half a dozen here.
Okay.
So we've got Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins from Top Gun.
That song rules.
I know, right? And I picked all ones that were like made for the movie.
Yeah.
Right? Eye of the Tiger by Survivor, which was made for Karate Kid, but then used for Rocky III.
Oh, yeah.
Ghostbusters by Ray Park Jr.
Okay, nice.
My mom had that tape, and I remember listening to it in the basement all the time. Like, dancing around Ghostbusters. Right.
I thought he was a way bigger star than he was.
Me too.
You know, because he just seemed like in the video, like, oh, this guy must be really well known. He's so well put together, and he's handsome. I'm like, and everybody seems to know who he is. But I didn't realize that Ray Parker was, he was kind of, you know, kind of anonymous.
I know, right?
Aside from the song.
It's surprising.
Right.
You got Call Me by Debbie Harry from American Gigolo.
Yeah, man.
The Heat Is On from Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
I love that song so much. I used it in a skate video I made back in the day. So I was like doing like half cabs and like crooked grinds to The Heat Is On.
Oh my God.
It was awesome, man. Yeah. Mrs. Robinson, Simon and Garfunkel, classic. I prefer the Lemonheads version, honestly.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I just like the punkier vibe to it.
Yeah.
But they're both good. And my two favorite probably are Dream Warriors from Nightmare on Elm Street 3, just because it's just ridiculous.
That's a great
song. You
know,
it's so good and it's so insane.
Yes.
And the music video is awesome. Like at the end, Freddy wakes up from a nightmare of Dokken. And he goes, who were those guys?
I know.
It's so stupid. But my favorite, the best, you might say, is You're the Best by Joe Esposito from The Karate Kid.
Man, listen, I've been singing You're the Best, since 1985.
Me too.
Like, it's been in my head all that time.
Yep.
And nothing makes you want to exercise more than that song, you know?
Yeah. Eye of the Tiger comes close.
Yeah.
And they were both Karate Kid related.
Yes, they were. That's true. Holy crap.
All right, that's my exhaustive list. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I mean, obviously, music is another way that cinema feeds you.
Yes.
You know? And there's many times when you're watching a movie and a song that I'm unfamiliar with is featured. And in some ways, it's like the filmmaker is like sharing a mixtape with you.
Yeah.
You know, because you can then seek out that music. And then there's some pop songs that are so closely associated with movies. And that's the whole reason we're asking this question. Because you can't hear them and not think of the movie.
Yep.
And these were very memorable for me, even though some people might say, what the hell is he talking about? Just like usual. But obviously, Simple Minds, Don't You Forget About Me,
yeah,
from Breakfast Club. That's one of the most famous ones. Peter Cetera did Glory of Love from Karate Kid 2.
Yep, I knew you were going to have that one, Dave.
It's just, I remember we talked about it during the Karate Kid 2 episode, and we were pretty tough on it, because, and deservedly so. But Peter Cetera really does have a beautiful singing voice.
Yeah.
And the song isn't great, but he's very nice to listen to.
And with the visuals of Karate Kid 2,
yeah,
and falling in love with Kumiko and stuff, like, it just blends so well.
I mean, like, yeah, the camera loves Tamlin Tamita.
Yep.
You know? But John Bon Jovi sang Blaze of Glory that was on the Young Guns 2 soundtrack. And I think that song might have ended up being bigger than the movie. It
probably was.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember when the video came out, it said John Bon Jovi. I was like, wait a minute. Hey, where's the rest of Bon Jovi?
Ooh,
you know, is John getting a singles push here? You know, what's going on? And yeah, sure enough, he like just had this other he's in the movie, apparently. He's one of like the gunfighters. I can't pick him out. Okay. I've seen that movie a couple times. I don't know where he is. But he gets killed on screen at some point, and I just don't remember where
it was. Oh, cool.
Yes. And then Starships, Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now from Mannequin.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that song. And everybody, if you want to see a really cool lip sync of it, watch the Skeleton Twins and watch Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig perform that song.
I've been meaning to watch that for years.
I love that movie.
Ugh.
Yeah. And, you know, on the Robin Hood thing, we talked about, I mentioned how, like, you know, Bryan Adams had that other movie hit from Don Juan DeMarco.
Yeah.
That kind of embarrassing thing he sings about, like, you know, have you ever really loved a woman or whatever?
yeah, I've never seen it, though.
Okay, you don't have to. Yeah, okay. Terrible song. But, like, my wife brought up something that I'd forgotten about. In between those two movies, he did it again with The Three Musketeers. Him, Rod Stewart, and Sting had that, do you remember this song, All
Not
for
really,
Love?
Like,
it was the biggest.
It rings a bell,
It was the biggest song of 1994.
It just sounds like another one of those generic pop songs that was a huge hit.
Oh, it is.
And I don't remember it.
Let's make it All for One and All for Love.
Oh, yeah, I know that one.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one. Bryan Adams was hired by major studios to pen earnest ballads.
Dude.
For you know, like swashbuckling adventures.
Okay,
there's
great.
Always sword fighting. there's always romance. And there's always, you know, like this kind of stuff.
You think he's going to get in the scores? He's going to be like Danny Elfman?
Well, it better happen soon.
Right, he's running out of time.
Yes. Yeah, that's the other one.
Wow, I thought of a couple more here. Like,
okay.
I like... Flash by Queen.
Oh, yeah.
I love that song.
Uh-huh.
It's ridiculous, but it's Queen.
Yes.
And they're ridiculous in many ways that are just so good.
And speaking of Queen, also like the Highlander theme.
Oh, God. Princes of the Universe.
Yeah.
A Kind of Magic is one of my favorite Queen albums,
yeah,
and it's because half of it is the Highlander soundtrack.
Oh, man. I know. Yes. It's they're just cool songs.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's so awesome. And then Power of Love. By Huey Lewis in the News.
Just,
I don't know if they wrote that for Back to the Future, but I mean, you can't think of that song without thinking of the movie.
They're linked. I mean, like, I can't hear that song without thinking about, like, you know, sketching.
Yeah, right. You got. You know? Yeah, I should use that in a skate video.
Yes.
All right, Dave. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, thanks everybody for all the responses. It was a great time as always, and I really love talking about music on this one.
Oh,
it was fun.
Man,
we don't always get to talk about the music. So, Dave, why don't you tell everyone where they can reach us?
Yes, we're on Facebook, Blue Sky, TikTok, and Instagram. Look for Dudes on Movies. And our email address is dudesonmovies@gmail.com.
That's right. And stay tuned next month when we respond to May's questions. I'm your dude, Scott.
I'm your dude, Dave.
And we'll see you next time.